hollers down to his friends on the raft below. They shout back their affirmation. One final hop, and he is descending toward the rippling green of the East Sea. Back on the shore, Min and Hwa and Kim are frolicking like children in the sand. Alex sits on a beach towel, watching impassively as Hwa dives back and forth in the water, returning to the shore each time with a handful of clams, a skill he learned in the army, as troops are often required to forage for their own food. And this beach is a gold mine. A clam mine, since nobody except for foreigners can use it, and the foreigners rarely come. The more he finds, the more excited he gets. We will bring the pile back to the hotel with us, give it to the chef to prepare for dinner tonight. Meanwhile, Min and Kim busy themselves drawing huge hearts in the unleavened sand with their toes, snapping photos on their phones. Kim writes the name of his daughter in the middle of one. Min writes the name of a boy she likes, takes a photo, and then quickly erases it as Alexander approaches, wrapped in a towel. Chapter 36. When she was 16, for reasons she still can't fathom, one of Eunju's closest friends ratted on her. The Baobu did a search, found a couple of South Korean K-pop CDs. She was sent to prison. She was beaten by the guards on a nightly basis. For no reason, all unprovoked. The beatings were savage and severe. She permanently lost her sense of smell. Still, she managed to avoid the fate of one of her cellmates, who was taken away by the guards each night and raped. This girl, Eunju told me, became like a zombie. During the day, she would stare straight ahead, unmoving, or else rocking herself, unblinking, never uttering a word. Eunju quit bathing, smeared dirt in her hair, did anything she could to make herself appear as ugly as possible so that the guards wouldn't want to touch her. Finally, after 2 months, her parents managed to come up with enough money to bribe the authorities to release her. Unlike most of the refugees who defect to the south, Eunju's reasons for leaving the DPRK were political rather than economic. Toward the end of his life, her grandfather, the university professor, became enlightened or else afflicted with loose tongue syndrome, depending on how one sees it. He began blabbing, speaking his mind a bit too freely to both his students and colleagues. Funny ideas. Dangerous ideas. Things you're not supposed to think, let alone say aloud. That this mess they were living in was not real socialism. That comrade Kim Jong-il obviously didn't care about his own people. A real leader would never allow his people to starve, putting all his money into the military instead. That America was partly to blame, for sure. But another cause of the problem was right here, in Chosun. That together the people could do something to change it, rise up, bring back real socialism to the homeland. The final straw came when her grandfather was invited to Pyongyang to give a lecture, and began speaking in this way. Shortly after his return to Wonsan, he came over to Eunju's house one day to visit the family. As he approached their front door, a black car drove up to the house. Two men got out, grabbed her grandfather, and drove off. They called the local police station. They called the security bureau. The party cell. Every office they could think of, day in and day out, trying to find out what had happened to her grandfather. Nobody would give them any information. 8 months later, they received a phone call. "We have your father," the police said to Eunju's mother. "You can come collect his body." Her grandfather's corpse was battered and bruised, nearly unrecognizable. Eunju couldn't even begin to imagine the long, drawn-out pain and suffering he must have endured. Over the course of those 8 months, they had managed to break every bone in his body. To this day, She is tortured by mixed feelings about her grandfather.
"He's my hero," she'll say when referring to him,
her voice swollen with love and admiration for his bravery. Then, a few minutes later,
"How could he have been so stupid? Why did he say those things? What the hell was he thinking?"
After they buried him, there was no sense for Eun-joo to remain in Wonsan, in North Korea. Her grandfather had damaged the family's songbun so badly that her days in the performing troupe were finished. She would never be permitted to sing or dance on a stage again. Her art was her life, and at the age of 18, her life was now over. Chapter 37. As the sun sets, we check into the Tamyung Hotel, one of the DPRK's bizarre architectural masterpieces. A structure that uncannily looks both hopelessly dated and like the prototype of some future building. Or else a model from an undergraduate architecture class that, in any other country, would have never been greenlighted. A diamond-shaped structure sitting just on the lip of the shore, from which a rickety bridge crossing commences the Changdok Jetty. The hotel's exterior was recently lavished in a marine blue. On my first visit to the country in 2012, it was sea green. Beside the entrance to the hotel's main 9-story bulk, a 2-story streamlined modern extension juts out to the right, almost like an afterthought, culminating by the edge of the pier with an elegant wraparound staircase that takes you up to a balcony that circles around the building toward precious sea views. Enter the dim lobby. Outside the capital, electricity is rationed sparingly, even in tourist-designated buildings. Squint to make out the details of the fantastic kitsch undersea sculpture that greets you. Surrounded by potted plants, enormous plastic lobsters, and sea urchins, complete with an arrangement of shells against a rocky blue background. The circular open floor plan allows you to look up at the top floor ceiling, from which dangles a massive chandelier with long tentacular hairs of fake diamonds. From my room, I'm treated to the daily show of the sun descending into the mountains over the East Sea. Somehow, I arrive at the perfect moment. I sit in one of the low chairs, positioned right in front of the window just for this performance of nature, and absorb every moment until the mountain has completely swallowed the gold orb, and sky's flux gives way to nocturne. Along the jetty, locals climb over rocks, searching for mollusks and other tasty treasures of the sea. The jetty culminates in a lighthouse-crowned islet, from which some of the best views of Wonsan can be enjoyed. I recall walking out there on an earlier trip, stepping over 2 slumbering drunks who were passed out on the lighthouse steps. I tried to enter, but the doors were locked. I followed the climb down to an unofficial fish market for enterprising local residents, where a woman with a bucket and a couple of knives had set up an improvised restaurant. For the equivalent of a few pennies, I enjoyed a sashimi breakfast composed of the morning's catch. The hallways are perpetually shrouded in darkness, making it difficult to get around, especially at night. On my way up to the restaurant, I make a detour to the 8th floor to see if I happen to run into Mark or Simon. They had told me in Pyongyang that they rented the entire floor as their DPRK business headquarters. Indeed, I see a bunch of Chinese businessmen hanging around in the hallway, smoking outside their rooms, but not our drinking buddies from the Sosan. I consider asking if Simon or Mark is around, but my instincts caution me against that idea. Upstairs, we are ushered into a private room Comrade Kim has reserved for our group. On the TV screen, instead of the standard Moranbong band concert or nightly news broadcast, they're showing a DVD of the animated film Kung Fu Panda. The moment they walk into the room, the Koreans' eyes attach themselves to the monitor. They're enraptured by every detail. The sophistication of the animation, the inventiveness of the characters' supernatural acrobatic abilities, the thrill and humor of the storyline, the catchiness of the music. The same fascination, come to think of it, as a foreigner watching the mass games. The waitresses lay out a magnificent spread. Naengmyeon and roast chicken and scrambled eggs and kimchi and bulgogi and green bean pancakes and potato salad and rice, plus some Western dishes like spaghetti and French fries, together with all varieties of crab and the shellfish caught by Hua, as well as the fresh catches from the East Sea down below, pollock and herring and mackerel and cod, all dressed in herbs and spices. And then there's the profound quantity of booze purchased earlier at the Kwangbok department store, now sprinkled in tiny soju cups across the table. We pour for each other, following the Korean custom of never serving yourself. The meal wears on, and jovial chatter is intermittently dispersed among the sunken, fascinated glares at the film and the commentary it provokes among the Koreans. Min proudly displays her familiarity by reciting lines seconds before the characters on screen. As post-meal cigarettes are lit, I submit to a beery haze as I chatter on amiably, relaxed enough after nearly a month in these people's constant company to let my guard down to a reasonable level, just above carelessness. Without rising, Kim casually commences an after-dinner speech. "Many of the foreigners who visit our country do not understand it," he begins. "I think the reason why is clear enough. It is because we are a socialist country, very different from how the other countries do things. We all know this, but you, gentlemen," he turns to the three of us, "you are different too. You are not ordinary tourists. And I think we, all of us at KSTC, recognize this. The main reason I am interested in this tour is because it is for intellectuals. I also don't speak with ordinary people." It is not the first desultory reference Comrade Kim has made to ordinary people. I'm starting to understand what it means here. That young man on the beach in Nampo, who wanted to practice his English, who told us he was just an ordinary worker. Min warning us never to do what we did to an ordinary tour guide. It is a covert reference to a class system that is said not to exist. Being elite, or a donju, or an intellectual, makes you extraordinary, it seems. "You have a good understanding of our country," Kim continues, "how we do things here. This, Alec, is what makes Tongil Tours different from other tour companies. And I want you to know that KSTC will always be here to welcome you to our country, to facilitate the interests, the curiosity, of intellectuals like you." We toast one last time and utter our words of thanks and appreciation to Comrade Kim. The end credits of Kung Fu Panda roll in the background. "Of course," says Comrade Kim, adding a final word, "one of the most important things is security, especially for Americans." He turns to me. "Alec and I have been careful to arrange that, and I was sure to speak to my contact in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs," he whispers. "When you travel with us, Travis, you will never have to worry." He winks. I smile, unsure how to respond. Making our way to the elevator, Ro grabs my hand, a wide, earnest look in his eye. "Comrade," he begins, "please promise me something." "Yes?" "Promise me you will always think good things about our ka." I feel my eyes starting to roll back in my head in expectation of yet another expression of nationalist zeal I've so often heard from North Korean men in states of drunken exuberance. "Mpani." Wait, did he just say our company? Not our country. Well, okay then. Startled, I step back and smile, returning his grip affectionately. "Don't worry," I tell him. "KSTC will always have a place in my heart." Chapter 38. Eunju's mother, was the first to leave. She was the one familiar with the route. A few months later, she sent a broker for her daughter. They landed in Shenyang in 2006. Shortly after, they were able to earn enough to send for Eunju's brother, selling the traditional Korean-style clothing they made. Shenyang has a large Korean community, including a sizable population of defectors from the north. For them, it is a dangerous place, like all of China, because the police periodically do crackdowns. If caught, they would be sent back to North Korea, where slow, painful, but certain death in a concentration camp likely awaited them. They worked and they saved until they had enough to pay a broker to take them the rest of the route, through Laos and Thailand, and then on to South Korea. Eunju's battles didn't end in the south. The plan had always been for her father to eventually join them, once they had enough to pay a broker. It is much more difficult, and thus expensive, for men to defect than women. Whereas women have the option of staying home as housewives, men are required to work, and work for the state. Since they're more highly monitored, that makes it much more difficult for a man to slip away for enough time to make it across the border to China. Brokers are among the richest and best-connected people, and live a gangster-like existence. Since their work is considered highly criminal, and since they need access to a constant flow of cash in order to bribe all the officials it takes to turn a blind eye and allow them to conduct their activities, they show no compunction about blackmailing former clients when times are tough. Those former clients usually have families they have left behind, and those families are in a vulnerable position. If it is discovered by the authorities that someone from their clan defected to South Korea, they can be punished. Recently, Pyongyang has sought to dispel this notion, using the case of high-profile defector Tae Yong-ho, a former diplomatic official at the DPRK embassy in London. Months after Tae's defection, CNN's Will Ripley, in an amazing piece of reportage, was astoundingly granted permission to interview Tae's brother and sister in one of their homes in Pyongyang. They looked healthy. The sister claimed that nobody in their family had been punished. The brother, however, hinted at the inevitable stains on the family's songbun. "If I don't wash this sin away by myself," he said, "my sons and future generations will have to work harder to pay for this." As Eunju and her mother and brother adjusted to life in the south, while struggling to save enough money to buy their father's way out, the broker back in the north began threatening to report their defection to the authorities and land the father in a concentration camp if they didn't send hush money. They endured the psychological torture of this blackmail until eventually reaching the painful decision to cut all ties with the broker, giving up the dream of being reunited with the family patriarch. Chapter 39. In the morning, I awake to what can only be described as a crinkling sound. Is there a malfunction in the air conditioner? Perhaps even a fire somewhere? I lift myself out of bed, groggy, to investigate. It seems to be coming from the direction of the window, so I pull the blinds open. Seven stories below, directly beneath my room, a volunteer work unit of some three dozen, all diligently at work in squat, crushing rocks with hammers, punishing my lazy bourgeois ass for daring to sleep till seven on a Sunday. And I thought Sunday was the designated day off for everyone. Not in Wonsan, at least. I have a shower, go upstairs for breakfast. I feel strangely unaffected by last night's drinking. Everyone else is already seated at the breakfast table. This time we're dining communally, in a room overlooking the harbor. Min is in a particularly dapper, chatty mood. As the waitress pours my coffee, she asks about my university studies. She knows I've just finished my PhD at the Royal College of Art in London, but what about my undergraduate years in New York? I tell her I studied literature and philosophy. She asks if I abide by an official philosophy. I ask her what she means by that,
Well, you know, here in Korea we have the Jucha idea, she replies. Is there an official philosophy in America or Germany?
I tell her, no, that in the West, philosophy operates differently. That there's no one central idea that is meant to sum up the meaning of all life and reality. Instead, philosophy serves as an open-ended quest for truth, one that necessarily has no finite, conclusive point. She appears unsatisfied with my answer. Well, there is one parable that I've always liked, that holds great philosophical sway for me, I say. You've heard of Socrates, who is regarded as the father of Western philosophy? Min nods. Rings a bell, at least. He was asked who the wisest man in Athens was. He said in response, I don't know. I know a lot of wise people, but I don't know who the wisest of them could be. Give me 1 week to figure it out. So he went around Athens, interviewing all of the wise men and women he found, asking them to tell him all that they knew. And at the end of 1 week, he returned to the man who had asked him that question. He told him, I figured it out. I'm the wisest person in all of Athens. The man was aghast. How had he reached this conclusion? Because, said Socrates, I'm the only one who knows that I know nothing.
Ha! Min laughs, and then looks perplexed. But what does it mean? She asks.
Well, I try. It illustrates how philosophy is meant to function. At least in the Western tradition.
But how can you be smart and know nothing?
He doesn't say he knows nothing. He says he knows nothing. Philosophy is knowledge about knowledge, thinking about thinking. So what the story means, I think, is that certainty about anything is an illusion. Even if we are told something is a fact, we can never really be sure that it's true, because Socrates would say, there is no such thing as certainty. There is always the possibility that what we believe to be true, that what we have been told is true, is merely an illusion, or propaganda. In a sense, there is no such thing as truth. There are only greater and lesser arguments. Min ponders this, as Ro translates the parable for Hua, who had been looking on at our exchange with intense curiosity. At the end of the story, he gives a similar laugh, and then assumes a ponderous gaze. Ro and Hua discuss it, puzzled, and then Min relays my interpretation of it. Hua pauses to consider it, and then digs back into his bean paste soup. Alexander glares at me from across the table, a slight grin on his face.
What?
I mouth. I was cautiously indirect, though I realize how dangerous the implications of everything I've just said are. But I can't be bothered to fret over it. Maybe it's reckless, but I don't care. I even feel relieved somehow. Far from being a gesture of defiance, it was more an act of self-assurance. More for me than for them. A way to demonstrate, however meagerly, that I still have a foothold in a reality much larger than the web I am currently caught in. I finish my breakfast in a state of total calm and relaxation, like how a Catholic must feel after a morning spent at the confessional, relieved of all taxing psychological burdens, forgiven and blessed to continue onward. I go back to my room to pack up and prepare for checkout. The crinkling sound continues. I look out the window. They're still at it, those citizens of Wonsan, pounding away, turning rocks into rubble. They'll be there all morning. Breaking up big rocks on the chain gang. Breaking rocks and serving my time. Chapter 40. A few months after Eunju's arrival in Seoul, a major news station asked to interview her about her experiences as a defector. A pretty standard request. North Korean defectors suffer systematic discrimination in the South, and often experience difficulty finding gainful employment. One of the few ways they have to earn money is by selling their stories to journalists. Eunju agreed to the interview, with the stipulation that her face be blurred so as to protect her identity, and her father back home in Wonsan. When the piece aired, Eunju was enraged to see that they did nothing to conceal her face. She contacted a lawyer and was preparing to pursue legal action against the station for breaking its agreement. "But you're a performer," the representative from the station argued in response. "Don't you want to be famous? Now everyone knows who you are. This is going to help your career." "No," she said. "I'm a stage performer. I have no desire to be famous on screen, and certainly not at the expense of my father." When it became clear that she had no intention of reneging on the lawsuit, the station's representatives upped their game. They told her that if she was going to behave this way, she would never make it in South Korea. That she would earn a reputation for being difficult, for being a brat, and that no one would ever give her a job, that she would wind up a failure. She considered this. She was a new arrival in the South, after all. Perhaps they were right. She still only had a limited means of understanding how the society functioned. Dissuaded, she agreed to drop the case against them. It was too late, anyway. Soon after the piece aired, the police in Wonsan came for her father. He was thrown in prison. Luckily, by this time, she and her mother had earned enough money to send to North Korea. Enough, at least, to buy her father out of prison via another broker. In order to save himself, for the DPRK now had clear, televised evidence that the family had defected, her father had to divorce her mother in absentia, publicly denouncing his former family. Soon after, he remarried. The last time Eunju spoke to her father was 4 years ago. With a broker, he had traveled to a border region where mobile phones can pick up signals from China. Defectors often speak to family members they have left behind in this way, but they only have 1 or 2 minutes. If they speak for longer, the security apparatus might pick up the signal and be able to locate them. "The call was nothing," Eunju told me. They couldn't have much of a conversation in that tiny sliver of time. "My father just kept repeating, 'I'm sorry,' over and over again." Since arriving in South Korea, Eunju's done a little bit of everything, work-wise, to survive. Minus some of the more unpleasant jobs her female compatriots have unluckily fallen into since leaving the North. Eunju herself had been used, virtually raped, any number of times since leaving, mainly in China when she was still green to the ways of the outside world and would believe anything any man told her, only to see him vanish as soon as he got what he wanted. She knew that any kind of sex work, be it online chatting or real-world prostitution, wasn't for her. Nor has she ever opted to become a professional victim, which is what, she says, participating in the celebrity defector culture effectively amounts to. She's seen so many go this route, and she can't really blame them. Though it is a rule that every student learns on day one of any introductory journalism ethics course, any information you pay for is bad information. South Korean and foreign journalists alike are quick to forget it when it comes to interviewing North Korean refugees. Since the years of the Arduous March, which launched an exodus of economic migrants on that perilous journey through China and Southeast Asia to South Korea, the defector's tale of woe and suffering has become a cottage industry in publishing and the media. Defectors quickly come to learn of the harsh reality of life in the South, a reality that nothing in the North prepared them for. It's well known that South Korea is considered one of the most competitive societies. But what does this really mean on a day-by-day level? To understand the prominent role that nepotism plays in South Korea, one need look no further than the chaebol system. Chaebol, which means loosely wealth clique in Korean, refers to the powerful family-run conglomerates with close ties to the government, companies like Hyundai and Samsung, Undoubtedly, these chaebol are responsible for the rapid acceleration of South Korea's economy since the 1950s. Ironically, the chaebol system has many striking parallels to the elites occupying the top of the Songbun system in the north. In both countries, a certain number of powerful families form the unofficial upper crust, securing all wealth, power, and opportunity for themselves and their minions. In the DPRK, these families historically aligned themselves to the Kim dynasty. While in the ROK, these families, most of whom opportunistically served the Japanese during their occupation of the peninsula, similarly married themselves as closely as possible to the seat of political power. It was under South Korean dictator Park Chung-hee that the industrial empire of the chaebol system was established, thanks to the granting of government loans. The chaebol system operates a trickle-down effect. As a result, South Korean society is tribal, clannish. Those in positions of power are more likely to give jobs and other opportunities, when not to family members, to those they went to school with, those they grew up in the same neighborhood alongside. Outsiders have no hope of penetrating such a system. Very few South Koreans wish to have anything to do with North Korean defectors. Among those few, one finds the typical range of opportunists: Christian pastors, right-wing politicians, exploitative employers, and journalists, eager to use the extremely vulnerable outliers toward the accomplishment of their own dubious ends. Socially and economically, the majority of the South's some 30,000 North Korean defectors are left to suffer the humiliating consequences of their systematic exclusion from the mainstream of ROK life. That in their home country, they were conditioned to view themselves as little more than human instruments of propaganda, makes them all the more ripe for exploitation upon arrival in this new land of freedom. Finding every door of gainful employment shut to them, Eun-joo explains, some refugees, unsurprisingly, have found that there is at least one, potentially highly lucrative, way to make ends meet: by telling their stories. North Korean defectors have become best-selling authors and television celebrities, and are highly sought after on the lecture circuit. Eun-joo, like many defectors who happen to have that winning combination of being bright, physically attractive, and articulate, has dabbled in this world. But ultimately, she sees it as a dishonest spectacle. Defectors are incentivized to exaggerate and fabricate, and it is an endless cycle. The more one talks to the media, the more famous one becomes, the more one is expected to give them. Add to that the psychological ailments that many defectors suffer from, not only from whatever they might have experienced growing up in the DPRK, but from the traumas they've experienced in China and Southeast Asia on the escape route, not to mention their subsequent ostracization and exploitation in the South, and you have a situation ripe for unreliable testimony. Because the media, in the end, only want one thing. "When you say that line on the air, we need you to cry," the talk show producer instructed her friend, when she went on a popular television show where North Koreans talk about the horrible lives they endured in the North, while boasting of the great freedoms they enjoy in the South. "Can you cry for us? Real tears. Because otherwise, no one will believe you." For the biggest stars of the circuit, a peculiar problem eventually arises. Once you have given the media everything, what more can you give? Invention, as well as borrowing details from others' life narratives, becomes a necessity. That borrowing, it turns out, isn't all that hard to finagle. The defector community in the South is quite close-knit, and everyone knows each other. Eun-joo remembers the email she got from one young woman she knew who went on to become a major star on the defector circuit. The email was sent out to practically everyone, Eun-joo says, asking for traumatic details from their lives in North Korea and subsequent defection for a book she was writing. She had gotten a deal, but was clearly having difficulty piecing together the kind of victim narrative that her publisher and journalist co-author were after. Eunju ignored the email. Others didn't. Their stories became hers in the course of writing the book, forming a gruesome autobiography of life in the brutal police state and the perilous yet ultimately redemptive passage to freedom. Her fellow defectors didn't complain publicly that their stories had been stolen. People who are disempowered seldom do. And even when they do speak up, they are usually ignored. Minor controversies over inconsistencies in her story have erupted since the book's publication, but they have been largely chalked up to psychological trauma, the burdens of childhood memory, and the celebrity defector's difficulties with communicating in English. To Eunju's annoyance, nobody has called into question the larger, systemic problem in which these issues are rooted. The book continues to sell in large quantities all over the world. Her TED Talk, featuring, of course, real tears, is a favorite share on social media. And her appearances on the lecture circuit are rumored to command fees of 5- and 6-digit figures. Says Eunju, "When I look at her, I just see a person who is really confused. I genuinely believe she no longer knows what's true and what's not. She no longer belongs to herself. She's become a tool, from one system of propaganda to another." What bothers Eunju more than the apparent corruption of the celebrity defector industry, she is wise enough after all to realize that corruption is rampant everywhere one looks, even here in the so-called free world, is an even more nebulous form of dishonesty that, to her, is profound in its power to corrupt. It is that people forget who they are when they come to the South. And they forget without ever reconciling with the past. When Eunju finally made it to the South Korean embassy in Thailand, she was thrown into a waiting cell with about 400 other women. At that time, there was a particularly high number of defectors coming through, and for whatever bureaucratic reason, the embassy told them that only 5 could fly to Seoul at a time. She would have to wait her turn with the others. "They turned into animals," Eunju said. "It was like we were trapped in this cage. It brought out the worst in everyone. We were no longer human beings." Since the women were not, in fact, being held prisoner, but merely awaiting their transport to freedom, they were pretty much left to their own devices in the overcrowded communal space, which they couldn't leave, since it would mean leaving South Korean territory and losing their place in line. A gang-like atmosphere of terror prevailed, with the toughest women setting the rules and brutalizing all those who didn't obey. "One teenage girl was 5 months pregnant," Eunju relayed. "She secretly went to the embassy officials and asked whether she might skip the line because of her condition. When the other women found out about it, they surrounded her, a gang of them, and beat her until she miscarried." Each of the brutalizers commanded her own territory, an area on the floor surrounding her mattress. If you even accidentally stepped onto that territory when walking past, you were liable to receive a beating. Eunju was selected at random to become one of their regular victims. In retrospect, she can't blame them. They themselves, she recognizes, had been brutalized. There were the regimentation and authoritarianism of daily life in the North, sure, and any number of traumas experienced there that they were running away from. What's more, many of these women had been trafficked, or else escaped from similar situations of captivity in the course of their route through China. It was to be expected that, for lack of empowerment, they would then exercise their own brutality over anyone they perceived to be weaker than them. The terror became so great that Eunju one day decided to escape from the holding center. It would mean she would never make it to the South, never get to see her mother again, who by then had already made it to the ROK. But anything would be better than the hell of being trapped in a cage with these animals. She was scaling the wall of the embassy when a security guard saw her and pulled her back down. Finally, one day after the women tried to attack her again, she grabbed a nail file she had hidden under her pillow and charged at them, growling like a rabid dog.
"Look at her," the women said, stepping back. "The bitch has lost her mind."
Eunju played the part accordingly. Imitating a madwoman, it meant she was isolated and friendless for the rest of the time she spent in there. But at least she was left alone. Such accounts, Eunju points out, are noticeably absent from all those best-selling defectors' tales. And there are good reasons for this. By those who were with her at the holding center at the embassy in Bangkok, at least one of those celebrity defectors, so beloved by the media for her sweet, gentle demeanor, has been remembered as one of the worst bullies. Chapter 41. I'm always taken to the same restaurant in Wonsan, on the same street as the hotel stretching along the port. I remember well my first visit here in 2012, because it was also the night of Kim Jong-un's first public address, the one in which he famously stated that the people should never have to tighten their belts again, subtly distancing himself from his father's tarnished legacy of the arduous march, and implying a renewed focus on economic development. We walked into the main dining room, and there he was on the large screen, all the restaurant employees and customers standing around in complete silence. My guides stopped in their path and joined them. Kim Jong-il rarely spoke in public. This was something new indeed. The deification cult of Kim Jong-un had hardly gotten underway, and most North Koreans simply didn't know anything about him, let alone what his voice sounded like. On my first night in the country, when I had asked one of my guides what she knew about the new leader, she stalled.
"I heard he is very kind. Very nice."
Then she asked carefully whether the Western media had reported anything about him. "Only that he was raised in Switzerland," I said. She nodded her head, though that was clearly news to her. And now, there he was, live on television for the entire nation to see and hear, speaking aloud, telling them that it would all be okay. A new era had arrived. After lunch, we strolled down the ginkgo-lined boulevard, past a typical shop selling everything from socks to household appliances, from televisions to antibiotics, to the provincial art gallery. Upon entering, you're met with an array of mostly underwhelming stock images on canvas, a mixture of classical East Asian ink motifs, but also Norco-realist oil paintings and Chosun-hwa scenes of abundance and happiness in the Korean people's paradise. It has all become a bit stale and cliché by now. As I make my way further through the gallery's corridors, however, I come upon something I have never seen before. I call the gallerist over.
"Who made these?"
"Oh, the one of the waterfall. That's Kuryong Falls. Have you been there? It's very famous, in Mount Kumgang. The artist is Lee Rong-hee, from Wonsan. He represents the newest style in Korean oil painting." The work in question is on a tiny canvas, the paint applied in such thick impasto in places that it borders on abstraction. The sludge forms two mountains, delineated by extreme color contrast. On the left, a clump of rich dark greens occasionally coalesces into a dire blackness, while the mountain overtaking the right side of the canvas consists of competing tones of white and beige, applied in hurried, though delicate swaths. Strokes that alternate between thick and thin, in some spots so thin, in fact, that the canvas material becomes apparent. The sliver of flowing water between the two mountains you have to strain to see. It is all but annihilated in the emotional swell of the paint. Follow it to the bottom, and it's not the colors, but the sculptural formation of the paint, a snaky swirl that pronounces the ultimate landing of the falling water. But the pool, such as it is, isn't actually there. For it is the same flesh tone of the rocky landscape hovering above it. And to the left, following the dark mountain's descent toward the landing stream, a clash of violets arises amid the increasingly grassy green. The birth of springtime, of fluorescence, is witnessed here, at the bottom of it all. Taking note of my enthusiasm, the gallerist disappears into the storage room and re-emerges with a massive canvas. "This," he exclaims, "is Li Ronghee's masterpiece, and it's not for sale." And it really is a Wonsan painting. A portrait of an old fisherman seated on the rocks of the Changdok jetty, not far from where I enjoyed that sushi breakfast once upon a time. He is an old man, his jacket rendered in mustard yellows, but it is the details of the wrinkles on his sun-battered face, the weathered, reserved glare of seriousness, of sadness, as he stares at the other end of the fishing rod, that gives the painting its rich, melancholic atmosphere. Fishing is an activity typically enjoyed by older men upon retirement in North Korea, a time when there is little left to do in passing one's final hours. But Lee's painting would never make it into the Korean art gallery in Pyongyang. There is no joy in his subject's face, no visible displays of contentment with life's rewards, no hackneyed signifiers of happiness under the supreme leader's guidance. It is far too true to life, too lacking in idealism, too dangerous in its myriad potentialities of interpretation, to ever fit well into the Norco-realist canon. I'm surprised to find a painter so deeply involved with the raw materiality of his art. As innocent as the painting may appear at first glance, such stylistic bluntness is as subversive as any I've encountered so far in all my travels in the DPRK. It harkens back to that moment not so long ago during the Japanese occupation of the country, when, north of the DMZ at least, Korea's art historical evolution was effectively halted. I recall those Moon Hak-soo landscapes in the gallery on Kim Il-sung Square, and wonder if Lee has seen them as well, if he is conscious that he seems to be picking up where Moon left off. When Korea was occupied by Japan, ambitious Korean artists would go to Tokyo to study. Japan was the first place in East Asia to import Western styles of oil painting as early as the 1860s. French Impressionism and Academicism, a combination of Romantic and neoclassical styles, became the overriding influences. When the Second World War came to an end, and Japan was forced to give up Korea as a colony, these styles were among the most popular in both the northern and southern halves of the peninsula. Whereas art in South Korea would continue to grow and evolve on par with an increasingly globalized diversity of styles that eventually fell under the aegis of contemporary art, something else happened in North Korea. Art's evolution came to a halt with this style, or else evolved according to its own new state-sanctioned dictates, depending on one's point of view. But Lee has taken painting further, into an even more individualistic mode of expression. The gallerist smiles at my excitement, leads me into the back room, where he begins to lay out stacks of unstretched canvas across a small wooden table. More canvases by Lee, but also similar works by two other Wonsan painters, Cho Ho-in and Park Eun-gwan. All of the canvases are quite small, like Lee's. Still, I'm amazed to find, here in Wonsan, what amounts to a new school of expressionist landscape painting. None of these paintings can be found in Pyongyang. The artists are unheard of there. It makes you realize the extent to which not only is North Korea as a country cut off from the rest of the world, but most of the cities and regions within the country are similarly cut off from one another. In one of Choi's paintings, a farmer is shown mending a fence. Unlike the standard propagandistic works of this genre, depicting agricultural effort as the collective endeavor it is officially meant to be, this farmer is solitary, alone. A clear reflection of the new era, where people have taken to growing their own food for both personal consumption and profit. A practice that began in desperation and defiance, but that the government gradually had to legalize. As in Lee's painting, it is the colors that make everything come alive. that transform what could otherwise be a rather grim scene, and probably is in actuality, into a captured moment of deep reflection and beauty. This is cerebral painting, melancholic in its finessed effect, miles away in distance and sensibility from the obvious kitsch of the capital. It signals a subtle pragmatism. Everything may be broken here, but we will just repair it, as we always do, since nothing new, no replacements, will be on their way. We must make do with what we have, with what we've inherited. Finally, there's Pak Eun Gwan, who the gallerist tells me is the oldest of the three artists, already in his 80s. Unlike the other two, Pak gives more care to the human form in his painting of a narrow lane dividing a hillside village. Four small figures are seen making their way up and down the street, children on their way home from school, made obvious more by their colorful backpacks than their diminutive stature. More than the houses and network of telephone poles, the Cezannean strokes forming the mountains in the background, your eyes are drawn to the sunburnt face of the small girl coming toward us. Amid the beige white of the houses making up the side of the street, the eyes might nearly overlook the form of a distraught beggar woman, or grasshopper vendor, crouched against one of the houses. A shockingly revealing painting for any DPRK artist, which is likely why it is partly erased. These paintings tellingly depict the lateness of the day, the hour. A quiet rebellion. For me, it is an invigorating moment of discovery. No one else has seen these works. The gallery is empty, after all. Presumably not even locals care to visit. Probably no one else will see them for a very long time, if ever. It dawns on me just how truly isolated these artists, these people, are. But also, I feel momentarily rescued from the well of cynicism I have lately fallen into by the realization that it is still possible to discover something wholly new in this world. Here, far from the prying eyes of officialdom, you have artists resisting state-sanctioned idealization in favor of a synesthetic, highly individualized perception of blunt reality. A small sign of resistance, perhaps, but one that cannot be underestimated. There is such a thing as expression here. I climb back into the van with Hua, who's pulled up next to the gallery. Suddenly, the traffic cop from yesterday, the one we'd snubbed, appears. He demands Hua roll down his window, asks to see his license. Hua produces it. The cop grabs it out of his hand and continues walking toward the square up ahead. The rest of our entourage takes their seats in the van. Hua tells Comrade Kim what just happened. The traffic cop is standing at the intersection up ahead, just at the entrance to the main square. Kim tells Hua to drive up, park in the middle of the square, leave the engine running. Kim slams the door behind him and runs back toward the cop. A lengthy argument ensues. The cop has no reason to disguise his repugnance. These arrogant assholes from Pyongyang think they can come to my town and piss all over it? You want your driver's license back? Well, guess what? Your driver disobeyed a traffic cop, comrade. Oh, I'm sorry, you've got foreigners in the car? Are you losing face here? Well, tough fucking shit. This is Wan San, asshole, not some backwater stinkhole. The supreme leadership has a house here. Tourists don't make you and your driver exempt from following the traffic laws of Chosun. As the argument wears on, the price in the officer's mind increases. First, Ro gets out, thinking he can pull some local sway. A true son of Wan San, after all. Maybe they know the same people. Min follows shortly thereafter. Hua remains frozen in the driver's seat, scared shitless. What can he do? He was just following the big boss's orders when he accelerated past the cop. Now, it is up to the boss to get him out of this disaster. He has a perfect driving record so far. He's never had an accident, never a single traffic violation. North Korea operates on a three-strikes system. You hit three, and your license is taken away. Your driving career is over when that happens. Of course, nowadays, you can bribe your way out of it. He is hoping that's what Kim will do. Worst-case scenario is that he emerges from all this with a strike on his license. He'll get shit for it back at the office in Pyongyang, regardless of whose fault it is. But it's out of his hands at this point. Alec and Alexander and I wait in the car with Wah. The argument drags on for more than 40 minutes. I study the huge ship docked at the port at the end of the square. The Mongyongbong 92. This is the passenger ship that used to go between Japan and North Korea. The 92 refers to its year of construction, a gift for Kim Il-sung's 80th birthday, built with funds raised by the Chongryon Association in Japan. For a while, the ship would transport cargo, as well as Zainichi Korean visitors, between the shores of the two countries. Until 2006, when Japan finally banned North Korea from entering its waters. After that, the vessel was briefly used as a tourist cruise ship between the Rajin Special Economic Zone in the far north of the country and Mount Kumgang. Since 2015, it's been docked here, dormant. For Zainichi Korean repatriates living in Wonsan, it must serve as a painful daily reminder of their separation from the loved ones they left behind in Japan, and the increasing unlikelihood of ever being permanently reunited. It is not Comrade Kim's first run-in with the authorities. But most North Koreans have had an encounter with the fuzz at one time or another. That's just one of the inevitabilities of life in a police state. Local cops are little more than thugs in uniform, most of them looking for bribes of cash and cigarettes and nothing further. They are by far easier to deal with than the Baobu, the Ministry of State Security officers charged with investigating offenses of a political nature and who operate the country's notorious prison camp system. Once they become involved, it's either far too late or else the amount of the bribe will increase a thousandfold, beyond most citizens' ability to ever pay. With these lower-level cops, unless, of course, it is a very serious crime such as murder, an agreement can usually be reached. The trick is making sure it doesn't escalate to the point of blows, as they won't hesitate to deliver a severe beating on the spot in front of everyone who happens to be passing by. Which, if you're unlucky enough to get caught up with one having a bad day, you might get anyway. The presence of our foreign eyes, as well as Comrade Kim's announced credentials as the son of a prominent Pyongyang officer, spares him from such a punishment. It's getting the price down to an amount he is willing to pay, while securing the least repercussions for his driver, that forms the basis of the conflict. Whereas the cop sees in Comrade Kim a bratty sense of Pyongyang entitlement, Kim merely suffers from the very same deep-seated hatred of authority that is inborn in all inhabitants of a police state. It is this bottled-up hatred that frequently erupts in manifestations of physical violence. Kim is too proud and sophisticated to engage in such skirmishes. And anyway, he was never much of a skilled fighter, having lived his life in comfy, white-collar environs. And so he is more prone to committing these minor fuck-you infractions, like the traffic violation that has led us here. Now, he will have to pay for it. Others have noticed Comrade Kim's penchant for rebellion. It is one of the qualities that attracted Min to her boss. "He's like my brother," she once told me. It's not hard to see why. They both spent a significant amount of their lives abroad, and so have a good idea of how the outside world works. This tends to enlarge one's perspective on things. It also makes them a minority, among the world's sole cosmopolitan North Koreans. Comrade Kim's boss has noticed it as well, that the comrade seems to suffer from a potentially life-threatening malady, loose tongue syndrome, an affliction that can have deadly consequences, not just for the individual, but for all those around him. Kim is bright and a big earner, and his boss happens to like him on a personal level. He is, After all, a formidable personality, always cracking jokes and dispensing his worldly wisdom while at the same time running a tight ship of discipline and order.